Terra Versa.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so we continue with the issues and halachot pertaining to the meal, the Seudat Simcha of the wedding. An interesting question that is not an integral part of the actual meal, but has an effect on it, is a question of tefillah. In almost all cases of weddings, we encounter some kind of time frame that tefillah needs to be said. Even if it's earlier weddings, say this is a mincha, later weddings you have ma'ariv, and sometimes you can have both mincha and arvit. So what are we to do? What is the ideal approach? And otherwise, what should be done as far as tefillah? So the general principle in halacha, it's brought down in reference to mincha, and then afterwards, similarly in reference to kriyat shema, so therefore it applies to arvit as well, because even though tefillat arvit is less of a problem because of its time frame, but because of kriyat shema, on a practical level, we have a similar aspect of coming and fulfilling, maybe tefillat arvit more so because the mitzvah of kriyat shema, which is a mitzvah d'oraita, as opposed to tefillah that might just be the Rabbanan, even according to the Rambam, who holds tefillah as d'oraita, but a particular tefillah might just be the Rabbanan. In any event, yes. Yes, Bruce.
It's a nice thing at a wedding when there's different adults that are there. We had one Marav. But I'm just curious, since everyone has their own nusach, is it better that people daven then nusach if they have enough to make separate minyan? Or is it really actually better, you know, make one minyan and let them all daven together? We just had a wedding together, which is what we did. But there was a temporary discussion among some of the Sephardim to make their own breakaway minyan. And instead, we made one. But is there an opinion on that?
Okay. Without getting myself into hot water, I'll just note that whom you said had that discussion. It comes from their rabbinic leader, Alav HaShalom, who somehow pushed it that only their tefillah is the correct tefillah. But look, the truth of the matter is that it's hard to say one is more correct than the other. Okay? Let me ask you a similar but different question, which will help us understand the context. In a Beit Knesset, right, what's more correct? To have a set nusach, and therefore all those who daven another nusach will have to abide by that set nusach, or to allow that, according to the Shliach Tzibur, or whatever the Shliach Tzibur davens, for example, then the Tzibur davens that way. And in those situations, what should be done, we don't do it enough, but in those situations, what should be done is some kind of indication to the Tzibur what Nusach is being davened. Which of those two is better?
Before coming to Efrat, every shul I'd ever been in had a Nusach. And in Efrat, it's, I guess, again, the pride of the town. Whoever gets up to daven, that somehow that's the...
Most places in Chutzlaretz, shuls have a particular nusach, and that's what they daven. Right?
Some even
here, in Israel, here in Israel, it's more common to have that mix. Can you say one is more correct than the other? I don't think so. In other words, Rabbi Riskin, for example, held very strongly that there should be a nusach. But what he created by doing so in the shul and rimon is indicative of the problem. In other words, there are a lot of people who were unhappy davening there and basically broke away at the beginning and so on, to some extent because of that rigidness and that inability to express their own nusach. So you gain one thing and you lose another. I think similarly here also, if you have one tefillah. There's definitely an element of Rambam Hadrat Melech and the joint unity and so on. On the other hand, there's enough people, there is a place to come and say that let each Jew express things in their individual and in more intimate kind of tefillah. I really don't think that there's a right and wrong. I think that whatever is done need to be done in the correct spirit, the correct atmosphere. In other words, you daven together, then whatever it is, whoever is davening, that's what it is. Not like I once had a story when in Milim, I once came to some particular place and the circumstances almost more or less required that everybody daven together. So one guy got up and said that I have to be the Shliach Tzibur because I will be davening in this Nusach, and that's what Rabbi X said has to be correct. And that was almost like spitting in the face of the rest of the public, especially since most of the rest of the public did not daven that. On the other hand, you know, if it's a situation where there's a recognition that there's this broad type and you can have, you know, a proper minyanim of the different side, it's a place to come and say, these will daven here, these will daven in each one. And then if it's done in a proper spirit and not looking down at one another, that could also be acceptable. I don't think that one is right or wrong. I think that each thing benefits the tzibur in one way or another. And therefore, as long as it's done in what we call a menschlich form, a humane form, I don't think that one is right or wrong.
What did you do in the Beit Midrash when you were in yeshiva, when you were younger? Is there one nusach for the yeshiva? Or did it actually have different minyanim?
Theoretically, in the Gush, there was one nusach. Rav Lichtenstein just threw that away. In other words, the nusach that Rav Amital established was more nusach Sfard, and that was definitely in Yomim Noroim, the nusach that he used, and so on. But when Rav Lichtenstein got up to daven, when he was, you know, in a velut, he didn't even think about it, daven in Nusach Ashkenaz. And I know a friend of mine who had asked him also when he was in a velut, he said, there's no problem, just daven what your Nusach is. So that's the reality. Okay, let's get back to our issue. Tefillah. What we find in Halakha is that one should refrain from entering into all kinds of projects and things that one is doing, or into a meal. Some say even a small meal, others say only if it's a more significant meal, when nearing the time of tefillah. It's not only if the time of tefillah has come, but we already find an opinion, if it's half an hour before, one should refrain from beginning, because if they don't finish within half an hour, they'll be running into time of tefillah. Therefore, ideally, tefillah should be said definitely before the meal, if it's time of tefillah, before we begin the meal. In certain cases, it's both more convenient and more appropriate to say tefillah before the chuppah. And at least those who are there before the chuppah, therefore, can join in that tefillah. In any event, ideally, if it's time for tefillah, then the tefillah should ideally be said before the meal begins. However, if the meal begins in such a way that it's not yet time to daven, it's a relatively late afternoon wedding. One second. It's a relatively late afternoon wedding. They daven the mincha already. And then the meal begins. It's not quite time for arvit, right? But night sets in the middle. Or if for some reason they didn't daven, then if it's arvit, or if it's early enough mincha, one could say, finish the meal and daven afterwards. However, my opinion is, and it's based on the opinions in halacha, is that it's preferable to stop the meal when it's time for davening, to stop the meal, go say tefillah, and then go, come back. The reason for that is, A, because in general, there's always a wariness that if you push things off, you will forget. And people may not daven. And here, again, in circumstances of weddings, it, all the panorama of the wedding, and then you often have to drive back and so on. The probabilities of forgetting are notable, and therefore, that is one problem. The other problem is an issue that, right, wrong, and I sort of expressed my reservations to some extent about the alcohol at weddings, but the longer you wait, the more chance that more people will be under the influence of liquor, and therefore the tefillah will be more problematic. So the sooner you can say it, the more appropriate it would be, and therefore, to my mind, that would be the preferable choice, to say the tefillah in the middle. Yes, Bruce, what do you want to ask?
Yeah, so just as a quick review, perhaps, because you might have done this, maybe the word is a tish. So before the chuppah, normally I've gotten together with a large group with food and drink and some talk where the people sign the ketubah. They have, and in this case, they have the two fathers, the groom, the chatan was there, the edim. One of them was the rabbi of their shul in Talpiot, a Sephardi rabbi, and the other Abe was my neighbor. And my brother, you know, there were a couple of guys. And then the women were there, the two mothers, because they dropped the plate. So first the ketubah was read out loud, which I was surprised, because he's going to do it later anyway. He read all it with the understanding that the chatan should understand what it is he's signing at that time. So he read it and explained it. And then dropping the plate, the plate wasn't in any bag or anything. It just sort of shattered all over the plate.
Okay, first of all, Bruce, most of the things you mentioned here, we spoke about. I think some of them, you were in Chutz La'aretz. We spoke about them, and we mentioned that the Chatan, and not only the Chatan, the Eidim also, because they're the ones who are basically, the Ketubah is their declaration, have to understand what it is that is being said. We spoke about that.
There's no food or drink there. Is that sort of a more Sephardi? It was more of an intimate, quick. It wasn't the type of normal thing we normally see.
Again, it varies. Each person and in each family and each group does it whatever they in the way they want. In other words, if the chatan wants to be more part of the overall reception, receive people in the broad reception, then they may do it more, you know, quickly. And others, especially if it's a person has a lot of friends from yeshiva, they'll like to sit around and sing and say Kibrei Torah. So it really is something that.
And what was the one main reason to break this plate?
Okay, now as far as the plate, I don't know what exactly it was, unless they were signing Tnaim also.
Yes, well, they didn't say
Tnaim. At times, that goes back to what we spoke about a long time ago, that part of the process of the Tnaim is the breaking the plate again. It's similar, is the general idea of, because it was originally done before, way before the wedding, and it was a certain element of Simcha. We've come to an agreement on the wedding, and therefore, there was an issue of Zichron Churban in that city. Okay. I don't know that when it's done in a wedding, how critical that is, other than, you know, because this is the form and custom, because you're gonna break the glass later, but it has its place, and it's not wrong. Okay, so therefore, tefillah, again, ideally should be said, and therefore, when you're at a wedding, and you see that there's a minyan getting organized, tefillah should be said before eating. Now, when we're talking about the evening, my personal feeling is that you can be lenient with the definitions, the halachic definitions of Tzeita Kochavim, but on the other hand, to be somech and davening, especially as the Sfarim do, way before Tzeit, and especially since we're talking about Kriyat Shema, I think it would be preferable to wait, even if it meant that you would have to start the meal and then later stop, or just wait a little longer to go in. Sometimes it's a question of just, you know, waiting a few more minutes to go in. The worst case scenario, you won't get the first course. That's the worst case scenario. So that those are the parameters, but the awareness of the tefillah coming before the eating, and if not, then to do it as soon as possible, so as not to get to forgetting and not to get to issues of intoxication, I think are something that's important to note and keep in mind when dealing with these issues. Okay. The next question that is of interest is the issue of music at weddings. And some of you may have seen varied customs. You can go to weddings and they'll have a full band, a seven-piece band, nine-piece band, or whatever it might be. You can go to a wedding where there will be one or two musicians. And you can also go in Yerushalayim to certain weddings, though I think it's become less, I mean, maybe I'm just not roaming the right circles. But I think it's become less common than it used to be. But you will see in Yerushalayim in certain circles that there is no band. What there might be is a drummer. It's a drummer to keep the beat and help the people who are dancing and singing, but there will be no band, no outright music. The basis for that is, or the background for it, is that in Shulchan Aruch and Siman Tafkuf Samach, we find a whole collection that's basically brought from the Gemara and Bava Batra and other places in the Gemara, different customs for commemorating the destruction of Beit HaMikdash, or commemorating the Beit HaMikdash. Most of those are actually today not practiced. Some are. We spoke about it in reference to the custom of breaking a glass at the chuppah, putting ashes on the chatan's head. Bruce mentioned a few minutes ago the custom of breaking a plate during tnaim or something of that sort. But there are other customs that evolved and what were set. Some became somewhat different. Some were not kept for different reasons throughout the generations. They're all common in the sense that they are there to be a commemoration or remembrance of the Mikdash, and usually al rosh simchati. In other words, particularly when there is some sort of situation of rejoicing, some simcha. One of those things mentioned in the Shulchan Aruch in Siman Tafkuf Samach Sif Gimel, the Shulchan Aruch writes as follows: V'chein gazru shelo lenagen bichlei shir v'chol minei zemel v'chol mashmei kol shifir lismuach bahem. So this is basically taken from a Mishnah in Sota, that there was a gzera not to play music in and all kind, and not only that, it goes even further, mine zemer, in other words, group singing, and to rejoice with that. There is a broad discussion, and that's not for the framework of this shiur, but just be aware, there is a broad discussion in understanding, particularly this halacha, what it was exactly meant for, what circumstances, and how it applies. That question, therefore, has its relevance applicability to the issue of the wedding, the simcha of the wedding. And the simple understanding in the Shulchan Aruch is that since he does not in any way express a limitation to this halacha in a simchat mitzvah, that he holds that this training for music is something that is relevant also in a circumstance of a simchat mitzvah. Comes the Rama, okay, and makes a few comments. The first comment is that יש אומרים דווקא מי שתגיל בהם כגון המלאכים שעומדים ושוכבים כלי שיר. This whole gzera, and that touches on what I mentioned before, this whole gzera is a very limited gzera, that it only applies to those who are accustomed to doing what they normally do with the accompaniment of music. In other words, kings or people of that kind of stature that awaken to music, go to sleep to music, that music accompanies their life. So then there's a limitation that it shouldn't become too much because we should feel a certain weight of the chorma. And all the beit mishte, or in a place of mishte, there are those who interpreted things like bars, where when you add in the music, it sort of creates an extremely lightheaded mood. The Shulchan Aruch himself, okay, adds in afterwards, "V'kval na'agu kol Yisrael omal divrei tishbachot o shir hoda'ot v'zikrut kasdei HaKadosh Baruch Hu al-Yedei." Shulchan Aruch mentions that the accepted custom excludes singing. When that singing is songs of praise to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Divrei Tishbachot, in other words, all these songs that come, that give music to Tehillim and all kinds of things of that sort, piyutim of songs, that Am Yisrael, the accepted custom was not to include that in this prohibition. But again, as I said, that's as far as he'll go. He doesn't exempt or exclude Simchat Mitzvah from music. Again, and says, Haga, v'chein letzorech mitzvah, kegon beveit chatan v'kala, so too, that it's permissible when it is a framework of mitzvah, such as beit chatan v'kala, home of a chatan v'kala, the simcha, the rejoicing around a chatan v'kala. But when we take the first part of the sentence, and he says, v'chein, that could be understood only in reference to what the Shulchan Aruch said, that the custom is to allow singing. But then adds the Rama two words, hakol shari, all is permissible. And the Mishnah Brura comments here, and it's not just his opinion, he's basically reflecting opinions of earlier poskim. Hakol shari pirush ben bepeh uvein bekli. That for a simchat mitzvah, such as a wedding, all is permissible, singing and kli, musical instruments. So that we basically find that fundamentally there definitely is a halacha, a gzera, that says to limit music and consequently limit that sense of rejoicing. The question is its parameters, and particularly what we are interested here, its application to a situation of simchat mitzvah, a rejoicing of mitzvah. Sukharov sins. He doesn't say it explicitly, but by not excluding, he seems to indicate that even in a situation of a wedding, there might be some such halacha. The Rama rejects it. The Rama says, no, at a wedding, one is permitted to have music. Extent that at least in amongst Ashkenazic poskim, the acceptability of music at weddings became a given, reflects itself in an interesting story. In the Sefer Eidut Yisrael, he speaks about this idea, the question of music at the meals of the wedding. He tells a story. Let's see if I can find it here. He tells a story that is actually told in the Minhagei Maharil. In other words, you're talking going back to Rishonic periods. And he says like this: "V'siper lanu mase she'ira lefanav, an event that occurred, asher meta moshelet hamdina. The queen died." Okay. Right, we're in such circumstances. The Moshel HaTemdina died. The queen died. V'lichvodat tziva ha-Moshel shelo lenagen b'chol medina ota ha-shana shum klishir. And the sovereign, the king, ordered that in that entire country they refrain from playing music and songs, an entire year. Avelut, right? Like we know in Avelut, refrain for it. This was done as a form of respect. He felt that he was showing respect for his wife or his mother by making this decree. Then the Irasham Yot Nisuim B'Yishuvachad. And it happened to be in one of the towns in that country that there was a couple, a Jewish couple, that was meant to get married. And it was within that same year. And they asked the Mahari Segal, so they asked the Mahari Segal, should they have a wedding without music? And so first of all, you already see that the idea of using music was in the Rishonic period. Was seen as an accepted custom, but to the extent where there is a decree of the Malchut, there's a decree of the king not to have music, they raise a question. Halachically, is that correct? In other words, there's a certain sense that music is important and is an integral part of the fulfillment of the mitzvah of Simchat Chatan V'Kalah. His answer is the most amazing. The Mahari Segal gave them a halachic answer. He said to them, they should not have a wedding without music, because that is the core of the Simchat Chatan V'Kalah. In other words, without it, the Simchat, the joy of the Chatan V'Kalah, the Simcha around the wedding, becomes diminished significantly, and therefore, they should not have the wedding without music. And if it can't be done in their town, whether because it's risk as such, or they can't get any kind of exemption, let them go somewhere else where this decree of the king does not apply and have the wedding there. In other words, the Maris Segal sees the music as an integral, central part of the simcha of Chatan v'Kala, to the extent that he is, not only does he not say to them, okay, there's a special circumstance, I'll have a wedding without music. No, he says to them, A, music is integral to the simcha, and if only possible, if it can't be done in your own town, take the effort, make the effort to go from your town to somewhere else so that you can have music at the wedding. Without any question, this is a very extreme position, but it's brought in the poskim, and it reflects a common custom at the time that music was used at weddings, and not only was it used, but it was seen as part and parcel of the actual simcha of the suit. Again, it's not just these sources, the Stechem and others, bring in the idea that music should be played at weddings. However, as we said, there are those who take the Gemara, the Mishnah of the Gemara, to a practical level in refraining, and therefore there are those who do it by simply limiting the amount of music. Though, as I mentioned, let's just have one or two musical instruments, and by so expressing that though we have music on the one hand, on the other hand, we're not making this some kind of grand orchestra and grand rejoicing, but the music is there just to give the atmosphere to the dancing and the singing. And there is custom which is mostly practiced in Yerushalayim. I would assume that the reason it became customary in Yerushalayim is because that sense, when you're in Yerushalayim, where the churban is an acute kind of feeling, then you should express this more significantly. And there, they refrain from having any kind of musical instruments, with the one exception, the drum. The drum is not seen necessarily as a regular musical instrument, but something that gives a beat and enhances at least the ability to dance and keep some kind of pace or some kind of common pace for everybody in the singing and the dancing. So here, as we see, we have a range of different views. The custom that is most commonly found is that we do have music, and not only do we have music, it really is lively, to the extent that I think in Israel, it gets to a level of isur because of sakana, because the music is so loud that it's deafening and it should not be allowed to be played at such a loud volume because it's hurting people's ears. But the accepted custom is to take the Ramah and the Maari Segal's position in a complete allowance of music. We should be aware that there are sources, and therefore when you come to a place and you see that there isn't, or a very limited set of musical instruments, you can know that that is the background for that. Any questions on the context of playing music at weddings?
Yeah, what about the minhag that they used to do when they had weddings Friday afternoons and the Shabbat meal, they would hire non-Jewish bands to play? How is that even allowed? I mean, I can't even understand it.
Okay. First of all, I have a similar problem to you, Arthur. I was never aware of that until recently when I was looking up things here, and I came across that there was that custom in Europe. I was not familiar with it until now, or until recently. And when I first saw it, I asked myself, like, how does that work? Like, you know, I think that if I were to try to put it into halachic parameters and halachic thought, okay, the agreement with the non-Jewish musician or musicians is made before Shabbat. So there's no problem here of Amira Lenoch. The musicians are playing the music on Shabbat, but they're not really creating anything physical for you. Because where do we find? We find if a guy creates something physical for you on Shabbat, then there is an issue not to use it on Shabbat. But here, the guy is not creating anything physical for you. All he's doing is he's sounding music. You hear music. And on the other hand, right, sort of to reinforce it or to balance out our natural reservation of using something of a guy, there is the element of the mitzvah of being mesameach chatan v'kala. To the extent you just heard the Maharish Segal's position that this is ikar simchat chatan v'kala. And therefore, I guess that weighing that sense of the music being so central to the Simchat Chatan V'Kala, and the fact that you can define the guy playing as acceptable, I'm assuming that that's where it came from. And once it sort of, after a few times, became customary, I'm assuming that also those gut kind of feelings that you and I, Arthur, had also sort of dissipated because you're accustomed to it.
Well, the problem is that, you know, if someone wants quiet, they're going to tell the band to stop playing, or they're going to go over to the band and say, now's the time to play. They're in essence controlling what's happening on Shabbat in terms of music, or people go over and make requests.
Okay, so I think, First of all, I'm not sure that things played out the same then as they do today, as far as bands and so on. And therefore,
let me tell you what it also led to in Germany, which I found out historically much later on, was that, you know, Shabbat or Yontif, there would be long afternoons, and they would end up having dances with music. So it led to mixed dancing.
So forget the mixed dancing. I think that already would not be acceptable, because even if you come and say that technically there's no problem in what the guy is doing, which was the first part of what I said, but it's lacking the second half, that there is a purpose of the Simchat Chatan V'Kala. I think that there I would have more reservation. I've never, you know, looked into how did the post-game in Germany relate to that particular phenomenon. The other issues that you raised all can be resolved. In other words, if you really want to avoid everything, so you make some kind of schedule in advance with the guy. You know exactly what, you know, you could be eating, you know, and therefore, you know, he has, 20 minutes to play when they're dancing, and then he'll stop. But even if not, if you give him a sign, right? You make up a sign, you give a sign, now stop, and now start. I don't think that would be fall into the category of Amira La'akum, and therefore, technically, you could resolve those problems.
Well, it'd be the same as if you gave a sign to a servant to turn on and off your lights.
That might be the case. It's if you had, and I'm not sure that in all kind of places in Europe they didn't do similar kind of things. If the servant knew, right, that this was expected of him, you didn't tell him to do it now, and you gave him a sign that now I need my light, right, and he did it. I think that in many places in Europe that may have been something that was done, and you see it.
Because by extension, if you're wondering, for example, that you're allowed, if the reason you're allowed to do this is the Simchat the Chatan V'Kala, then you can take this a step further. For example, I don't know. What if the president of the United States wanted to give somebody wedding greetings on and it was Friday night? There was a Friday night a Sheva Brachot. So they have a guy come in and turn on the computer so the president can speak to them.
Again, you know.
I mean, how far do you take this?
Okay, that's exactly the point.
It's going to give the Chassan Kala, you know, they're going to feel good about somebody, someone of high stature calling them and wishing them Mazel Tov, but not on Shabbat.
Again, I agree with you, Arthur, that one can extend and play with these things. And that's always the question of where do you draw the line? And sometimes when sitting in a particular kind of environment, we can't completely understand the social halachic environment of another situation. And things that seem to us, you know, wild and way out may have been more normative. You and I think, will not as a whole use a goy for all kinds of things, a goy shul Shabbos for all kinds of things, unless it's really desperate. In Europe, it was definitely much more common. In the Haredi world, okay, in Beit Vegan, there is a particular place that you can find, I don't know if there's only one or more goy, you can go to a goy when you need a goy shul Shabbos to do all kinds of things. Here too, people from time to time will do things if it's something urgent comes up, and they'll go to, you know, the worker, the Filipino, this one or that to stop. But it's not a given thing. There it's institutionalized. There's a place where there's a guy, shul Shabbos. In Europe, that was much more common. And therefore, you know, the things that seem far to us may have not been that far, and therefore those limits. And therefore, also when something is done sort of softly, but is a custom that is seen in a closed manner, then the fear of taking it beyond becomes less. Some of those same questions that you were raising, Arthur, came up around all the issues of how far can you go with allowing all kind of Zoom things and whatnot during the height of the corona. Those are all questions that need a certain assessment, and you're going to find different assessments of different posting, where to draw the line and where do you feel that it's still within reason to be able to be contained, and where will it go or does it go beyond reason? I'm not going to try to express my own views and the particulars that you raised. That really has to be decided. And as I said, I don't know, when you mentioned the issue of Germany, I'm curious what the post-team there, how they responded. Was it just a social thing of the more lenient in halacha? Did the post-team speak against it, or was it something that became more accepted? I'm not familiar. As I said, I don't know that the historical bit.
Okay.
Any other questions in reference to the issue of use of music at weddings? Okay. In the few minutes we have, we'll start dealing with the final stage that has a halachic significance of the meal of the wedding, and that is Birkat HaMazon. So let me begin with some kind of a broad statement that I want at least people to keep in mind. I want people to keep in mind that I'll explain what the problem is. Ideally, when you come to a wedding, to be part of the Seudat Mitzvah, you should wash and eat bread. Once you've washed and eaten bread, then you're mitzareif, you join this group of people eating at the wedding, which means that you need to say Birkat HaMazon with a zimun with them. Now, from the point of view of Hilchot Birkat HaMazon and zimun, as long as there will be 10 people who remain at the wedding later, you can have breakaway zimunim, to say zimun and leave. The problem is that birkat hamazon at a wedding also includes aspects of a mention of the simcha, but more importantly, include the requirement of sheva brachot for the chatan and kala. And from an ideal point of view, halachically, when one participates in a meal, the suda of a wedding, one must participate or be there for the sheva brachot as well. We all know that that's not necessarily a simple feat, right, wrong, or otherwise. In most weddings today, till they start, the Lenten dancing and this and that, and additional dancing, Sheva Brachot can be at 11, 12 o'clock at night. And that is not exactly the ideal conditions for most people, whether it's people who are older and staying up and then having to travel home with those hours is difficult, or it's people who have babysitters for their children because they're younger, or people who have to get to work the next day. Those are not ideal conditions. So first of all, I say, and I've said it before, though I don't have a voice or a position to get it across, I think that in any way that one can express this to families of chatanim and kalot, the sheva brachot should take place earlier than it does, so that it enables people to stay and participate in the sheva brachot. One solution can be that you have first set of dancing, you have the meal. After the meal, you say Birkat HaMazon with Sheva Brachot. And for those who are willing and interested to stay and dance further, then you have the next round of dancing after the Birkat HaMazon and Sheva Brachot. You can have, you can even delay the dessert to then, so that, you know, people have something to nibble on while that's taking place, significantly make it easier for people to partake in Sheva Brachot. There are different considerations and different family pressures and what one way or another, and it's not always simple, but I think that it should be kept in mind. I think it should be something that, A, when making smachot, that should be our consideration of the other people. And B, when we go to the wedding, to the extent that it's possible to stay for a Sheva Brachot. I have to admit that there are many cases where I want to stay for Sheva Brachot, and I wait and wait and wait, and at some point it just gets totally ridiculous, and I have no choice but to leave. But ideally, that should be the aspiration, and the Balei HaSimcha should, I think, accommodate the participants in that necessity. So, coming to issue of Birkat HaMazon, technically speaking, as long as there are 10 people that will remain, a person from the halacha of Birkat HaMazon could separate, say, a zimun and leave. But as far as the importance and necessity to partake in the Sheva Brachot, there is more of a problem. Everybody has to figure or calculate their considerations on these issues. Before we begin the actual Birkat HaMazon, there is customs in Am Yisrael that...
Can I ask you a question? Quick question?
Yes,
so if I don't wait for Sheva Brachot, and we make it all in the mezuzah, should I say Sheva Brachot, or I need the chatan?
No, you shouldn't say Sheva Brachot. Okay. The Sheva Brachot should ideally be with the presence of the Chatan Kala, and that's not the case.
Okay.
Before Birkat HaMazon, it's customary, definitely, on Shabbatot and Chagim, to say Shir HaMa'alot. And there are many people who say during the week, Al Neharot Bavel. There's an interesting question in reference to the meal of a wedding. On the one hand, the meal of the wedding is a meal of simcha, of rejoicing, and more than that, halachically, as far as the chatan and kala are concerned, it has a halacha of Yom Tov. The chatan and kala, the time of their wedding, has in many, there's no Isur Melacha like on Yom Tov, but in many other aspects, has a status of a Yom Tov. And therefore, there is reason to consider, and that is, I think, the more common custom, to say Shir HaMa'alot, as one would say on Shabbat and Yom Tov, before Birkat HaMazon of the meal of the wedding. However, there is an opinion that argues that the appropriate thing should be to say Am Harot Bavel and not Shir HaMa'alot. The reason for that is because in Am Harot Bavel, we find the pasuk. Im eshkachech Yerushalayim tishkach imni, im lo aleh Yerushalayim al rosh simchati. And there are those who say that the height of simcha is around the wedding. And now we're going to express that simcha in a bracha format. So therefore, this would be a correct and ideal time to once again bring forward that acknowledgement, that commemoration of the Churban, of the Beit HaMikdash that is destroyed. The same way as we did it during the Chuppah, we should do it again at the end of the meal before Birkat HaMazon, and therefore, according to that opinion, it would be actually more correct to say Al Neharot Bavel. Again, we're talking about customs, so it's hard to say right or wrong. Each expresses a different halachic dimension. One expresses the halachic dimension of the Yom Tov vis-a-vis the Chatan Kala. The other expresses the necessity in Simcha to remember the Beit HaMikdash, to note the Churban, and therefore either custom has its validity. Each can do as they feel comfortable. As I mentioned, at least what I'm familiar with, most places and most people say Shir HaMa'alot, but there's also a reason to say Al Neharot.
What about Bar, Shir HaMa'alot basically tied into when Tachnun is said? So,
yeah,
but
that's exactly it. With a Chatan Kala, Tachnun is not said.
What about a Bar Mitzvah? Bar Mitzvah or a Siyam, for example, you don't say Shir HaMa'alot.
Right, because all these situations, you could. There are those who would say Shir HaMa'alot because it's a status of Simcha. And it has. But it's not as intense as with the wedding. First of all, the simcha is less. The issues of yes, tachnun or not, the effect on the tachnun or not is something that is lesser. And there isn't the element, the outright halachic element that where we have in chatan kala, but then it's a halacha of yom tov. And for example, issues of the question of avelut, right? If a chatan gets married before a relative dies, then the shiva is pushed off, like a yom tov. so that for the chatan or the kala. So for them, it's literally a halacha of Yom Tov, which brings in more of a reason to say Shira. Okay, I will end here for today. Have a nice day and a Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next week will be the.